This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Monocle 24 on the 3rd of April 2012. Section D in association with Lexis. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. In this week's episode, we're packing our bags and fastening our seat belts as we talk design, transport and travel. So hop on board and be sure to mind the gap. Coming up, we hit the streets of Chicago on two wheels to see how the local bike scene is developing.
Aesthetically, you know, we're going for something more fashion-based. When it comes to cycling, it's really about people who want to feel comfortable in their jeans and wear a hat they feel comfortable riding in and want to be, you know, you want to promote that kind of easiness of riding.
We head to Hamburg to get the latest from the recent Aircraft Interiors Expo.
The idea is to replicate what passengers are experiencing in their everyday lives. And they're now always connected, they have always access to relative information about where they are. So we wanted to bring that into the in-flight experience.
And we return to England, to the town of Broxbourne, to visit the factory where the sturdy Globetrotter suitcases come to life.
Globetrotter is very much like an old friend. It is more than just simply a suitcase. It's something that holds memories and almost like a travelling companion.
All that, plus we sit down with a fascinating 21st century cartographer in Yale. And our very own Richard Spencer Powell delivers his pearls of wisdom on the beauty and beasts of airline branding. I'll also be throwing a couple of transport-themed songs into the mix too. So, cabin crew, get ready for takeoff. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Every year, come spring, Hamburg is host to the Aircraft Interiors Expo. It's a vast trade show for everything and anything to do with outfitting aeroplanes. It's a high-stakes industry, and design innovation is where the competition heats up. We sent our reporter, Julian Boner, along to discover what passengers have to look forward to in flight. And here's what he found.
With more than 500 companies exhibiting their latest products, this year's Aircraft Interiors Expo in Hamburg has been the biggest yet. The growing number of exhibitors reflects the ongoing fragmentation in the air transport business. The increasingly fierce battle for passengers drives airlines to seek new ways of distinguishing themselves from the competition. And one way to do this is through design. Sarah Davanzo is the director of trends and culture at the New York-based advertising agency, the Kaplan Thaler Group.
You can't really separate design and culture and consumer behavior. In fact, you could put a third element in there, which is technology. Technology, design, and the passenger behavior, they're inextricably linked. And so it's important for us to look at that whole experience, the design experience, and then also the technology that's delivering on the experience. And you can change every aspect of the mood and the experience through design or technology. Just changing the light color, for example, would change the mood of a cabin.
Light is indeed a relatively recent development in terms of cabin design and one of the trends at this year's expo. Flickering neon tubes underneath yellowish faded plastic covers are fast becoming a thing of the past. The future belongs to so-called mood lighting, generated by light-emitting diodes or LEDs. One system that's flying already is called HelioJet. It was developed by Lufthansa Technik together with Schott Lighting and Imaging. Armin Plichter is the general manager for transportation at Schott.
We try to address not only the lighting itself, we try to address the quality of light. And quality of light means for us homogeneity. And what we do here is we put the new LED technology together with a very advanced optical technology from Schott. And what we achieve is a very uniform light. And we can do color in addition. We want to add more comfort to the passenger, perceived quality in the cabin, especially for long-haul flights. People like that. You can easily adjust to the new time zone. You can relax a little bit more. All of us know that from a medical point of view, that the light, especially the color of the light, influences your complete body.
When you enter an airplane, it's not really about flying, it's about sitting. It's a piece of wisdom that's become a law of sorts for airline executives. Seats are what's closest to the passengers and one of the main features through which airlines can distinguish themselves from the competition. As a result, they're constantly being reimagined, a fact that's regularly reflected in the annual competition for the Crystal Cabin Awards, something like the Oscars of aircraft interiors. This year's award in the premium class products category went to the C3 Ultra Lounge. It's a premium cabin solution from Zio, a design studio that's part of Zodiac Cabin Interiors. According to Scott Savian from Zio, C3 isn't limited to just the seats, but takes in the entire cabin interior.
We started from scratch. We basically built a 777 fuselage and removed everything and said, how would we want to fly? What would be the things that we would value as a premium cabin passenger and designed around that. So we weren't beholden to the existing architecture of the interior. We took out all the bins, all the ceilings, all the sidewalls, and started really around the passenger place. And what we did was we had a couple of unique things in there. These wide-body aircraft are typically two aisles. We took it down to one aisle, and we made it a much larger, roomy aisle so that passengers and carts could pass each other. Made it much more easy to move around the cabin. But we also had what we call cross aisles going outboard to all of the seats. And what that allowed us to do was have a very nice business class seat and bed, yet give a direct aisle access to every passenger. So by reimagining the layout, we were able to accomplish a lot of things.
The industrial design team at Zio has an almost one-to-one ratio between designers and engineers. Savian says that it reflects the importance of design when it comes to passenger experience.
Particularly in the premium cabins, it is the difference. I don't think we can underscore quite how important that is. It's really nice to see design taking a lead role in the products that we put out. And so we're concentrating on that. This whole Zio team that works within Zodiac Cabin Interiors is a dedicated design team of a scope that the industry really hasn't seen before.
Welcome to Geo Radio on ABC Airlines. For the next 6.5 hours from here to Doha, I'll be your travel guide.
Meet the friendly voice of Geo Radio, a new development in the field of in-flight entertainment systems.
Heathrow is surrounded by large reservoirs. One of them, the Queen Mary Reservoir, is on the right. They were built starting in 1900.
Geo Radio comes from Thales Avionics. It's an interactive, three-dimensional moving map with an optional audio track that provides passengers with information about points of interest along the route. It also lets them explore the map for themselves. According to David Pook, Director of Product Strategy at Thales, it's a way of using technology and product design to give passengers more control.
The idea is to replicate what passengers are experiencing in their everyday lives. You've got the tablets and iPads, and they're now always connected. They have always access to relative information about where they are. So we wanted to bring that into the in-flight experience. But there is something very unique to flying at 35,000 feet, 500 miles an hour to a specific destination. I mean, the fact that I can actually see what it looks like out of the cockpit at any given time is something that passengers can never experience by themselves unless they become pilots.
But cutting-edge design isn't limited to the immovable fixtures in aircraft cabins, such as entertainment systems or seats. It's used to enhance all aspects of the passenger experience. One example are the complimentary products that airlines give to passengers before the journey. Formia is a Hong Kong-based company that specializes in luxury amenity kits with miniature cosmetics containers. The company's design manager is Adi Ng.
Every airline has their own image, and image now is really important in the world, the branding part of it. So when you go on board, you don't want to be exactly the same as the other airlines. So every single airline should actually have their own image, and you can do it by having good designs on board.
Formia's amenity kits integrate existing brands and designs with airline brands to enhance their image.
An existing image, for example, like you can see there for the Pouzzilari pouch. Pouzzilari is an Italian brand with masculine suits and all these things. So when we're looking at the design, we work with the brands and I try to, you know, think of it, okay, it has to be quite structured, it has to have something that make people think of suits. So we try to find fabrics which had this like pinstripe thing. So that when you look at this, you think, oh, actually, I remember this because that's like the suit I'm wearing. So it's little details like that that makes, you know, set it apart.
And setting oneself apart is becoming ever more important for airlines. The number of air passengers is predicted to double every 15 years. It's a huge market, and many airlines want a piece of it. The battle for passengers is fierce, and there aren't too many ways in which airlines can set themselves apart from the competition. One is design. No wonder, then, that it receives so much attention. For Monocle in Hamburg, I'm Julian Bohne.
We're going to take a short break now, but please remain seated. We're sticking with aircraft next, talking airline branding with senior flight attendant Richard Spencer Powell after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, airline branding for national carriers plays a crucial role in transporting a country's brand around the world. It's almost more recognisable than a flag. Lufthansa has one of the most beautiful, precise airline identities and services. And a new book by Lars Müller Publishers celebrates the history of its immaculate branding. I'm joined now by Monocle's high-flying creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, to talk us through it. You have brought along your copy of the Lars Müller published book that charts the history of Lufthansa's graphic design.
Yes.
And given this week's Section D is about travel and transport, I thought it would be nice to use it as a sort of kick-off point to talk about airline branding in general. But let's start with Lufthansa. Why is Lufthansa so successful?
From a branding point of view, I think there are certain famous branding exercises that were done around the sort of 50s and 60s that just kind of crystallise a lot of the thinking post-Second World War about modernity, about the Swiss international style. And Lufthansa just happens to be one of those case studies. It's an excellent piece of work, one of the best, but it also it's just an amazing kind of bit of luck in a way. It's one of the first airlines, I think, that really modernised from their 20s logo. And it summed up what suddenly air travel meant. You know, it was very jet set. It was just perfect timing. It's just beautiful. It's just such a nice, nice thing. It's a great colour palette. It's a lovely logo. It's simple. It's memorable. And it's just
sort of this combination of colour palette and logo and typeface that work incredibly well together.
Yes. And it's all come from the designer Otto Leicker, who was from this Ulm school of graphic design. And what's interesting when you read the book is that they're thinking, they did a report, they did a sort of, I think, a 64-page report to the Lufthansa board. And what they said in their report was that logos are declining and fewer companies use logos, and really you should just use a word mark, and that word mark should have a typeface, and the typeface should be on all your printed material, and that becomes branding. And what they said was the most important thing to brand a company was colour. Of course, everyone thinks of this Lufthansa yellow. We even, when I'm talking with Tyra about cover designs and we talked about colour, we'll always say, make that a little bit more Lufthansa. I know he means put a bit more orange into the colour. But I suppose if you think back to the 60s, when everything's black and white, you know, colour then was key. We just turned on to colour televisions, you know, colour printing wasn't absolutely everywhere. So if you could breathe this vibrant, vibrant yellow, you must have really stood out. But if you went into a branding meeting now and said, forget about logos, no one needs a logo, you just want a colour. I can't think of a company today that would accept that or that has sort of employed it other than perhaps the FT. I mean, the FT is a good example of colour in branding. I mean, you could look at the FT branding guidelines, and it probably just says, make sure you print on pink paper.
Yeah.
Full stop. That's it, one-page kind of document. So it's interesting how they simplified a very big, complicated company into one typeface and a very restricted colour palette.
And it's changed very little since, hasn't it?
It hasn't changed too much. They've added a bit of weight to the typeface, which I think they did in... I think Ottolike was involved in that, but I think that came from their in-house design team. And then I think in the 90s, the Swiss team added some colour. But I mean, when I say added some colour, they put some neutral greys in, into the mix. So it didn't really...
They didn't throw any purple around or anything?
No, fortunately. Purple and yellow wouldn't quite be a combination I'd associate with a modern German brand.
No. And moving away from Lufthansa, I mean, airline, and particularly for the national carriers, so brand identity is something that has incredible potential for selling national identity, not
yes.
just an airline.
Yeah, and I think it should. I think whoever designs a national carrier should have that as part of the brief. I think they should make sure that it succeeds on that point.
You've been involved, I think, sort of slightly on the fringes, is that fair to say, in the redesign of Swiss?
Yes, I helped out on the pitch with many others. I was sort of more involved in the publishing side of things. But yeah,
what was that like, though? I mean, everybody must have craved to get their hands on an airline from a design point of view.
Yes, they did. And I think, obviously, for Swiss, which is a particularly bad time, it was post September 11th, and they were grounded, huge financial problems, and they got huge backing. Obviously, it's a country-owned airline. So for them to actually go outside of their own borders to take on another agency, I think was quite a brave decision, but I think the right one. And it's very exciting. I think there's... must be one of the best jobs in the world to design an airline. It's they're just really exciting things, and it's surprising actually that there aren't more good airlines. That they seem to, many airlines seem to have picked bad companies to do their liveries, because when you're at an airport and you've got that 20 minutes before you take off and you're waiting at the gate and you see all the tail fins, there's not many that you really kind of fondly remember.
No, it's very true, and there's been some disasters, particularly British Airways, who've tried to refresh their tail fins, and it reaches national levels of panic.
Yeah, it's never that successful, which is a shame, because I think actually the Union Jack is a very distinctive flag, and they've not quite managed to sort of deconstruct it and reconstruct it onto their brand identity. It's a bit naff and neutral. It's a bit, feels like they've sort of, I don't know, it's a bit designed by committee.
Yeah.
Could be anything, BA. Whereas really it should be everything.
Which airlines get it very right, apart from Lufthansa, do you think?
I like KLM. Again, it's 50s design. It's off 60s, I think. It's not changed too much. I really like Iberia. Again, I love the colour palette. It's red, and again, it's sort of a Lufthansa-y yellow, white fuselage. It's got a kind of IB on the tail. You'd recognise it. It feels like a sort of pair of Gola trainers or something. It's a bit kind of kitsch, but it's great. I think American Airlines, again, big hitter in Massimo Vignelli, did the branding work. I think that's the only airline that hasn't been redesigned since its original logo. Yep, it's been untouched since.
Oh gosh, I didn't know that.
And of course, American Airlines are fascinating, the fact that their silver fuselage is because they couldn't afford to paint them, because it was expensive at the time, and that's then become part of their very recognisable brand. And
yeah.
Of course, they can't now paint them because they'd have to change. But I think they're some successful ones. And we were chatting before, I think Korean is also a very nice one. It's just lovely that they get the little flag, I don't know what that's called, that sort of yin-yang type symbol in there.
But, yeah, and I love the colour of Korean as well.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It puts a smile on your face.
It must be so expensive then to have painted the whole aircraft that colour.
I guess so, yeah. And that's something that we learned with the Swiss work. Funny story was we were in there to pitch. I was doing the publishing side of things. But one of the designers that was working on the branding took in two very nice models. One was white matte with a nice Swiss mark on the tail, and one was gloss white with a nice Swiss mark on the tail. And he tried to convince them that the matte version was really nice and no one else had it, and it had a very particularly modern feel to it. And they shot him down in the fact that matte paint needs to be cleaned like six times more often than gloss paint, which means you have to ground the fleet six times more, which I think, sort of
that doesn't matter, it looks nice.
Yeah, it looks lovely, but it costs billions of Swiss francs a year, so... That didn't go down too well. But
funny. How long, actually, from sort of start and pitching to completion, does it take to brand an airline?
That Lufthansa case study, that took 4 months.
Really?
So that's quite fast.
Yeah.
I think Swiss was a year, all in. I think it depends on your client, how brave they're willing to be. And there's just so many restrictions when you're doing anything to do with aviation. For safety, for weight, lots and lots of things need to be tried and tested, you know, 1,000 times. And it's, sometimes I think it's it feels like a very long time from when you first sort of typed in a logo and selected a typeface and printed it out to when you actually see it on the side of the aircraft.
Exactly, but one of the most satisfying things,
absolutely,
I'm sure, for a designer.
I think it's the ultimate, really, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the best thing you could possibly design.
So finally, if you could get your hands on an airline to design it, which would it be?
Probably BA, just because I'm British and I would like to sort that one out. But I've got a feeling it'd probably be, knowing this place, it would be Monocle Airlines that I'll be finally get to design.
Well, you joke, it won't be that far away, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Rich, thank you very much for joining us.
Welcome.
Time for a song. And what better track to keep us on a high than Big Jet Plane by Angus and Julia Stone. That was the beautiful Big Jet Plane by Angus and Julia Stone. And back to Earth with a smooth landing rather than a bump, and we find ourselves on the other side of the Atlantic, in Yale. While many of us may have turned our phones or in-car GPS systems to get us around, there are still a few cartographers out there doing things with map-making that show our towns and cities in a whole new light. Bill Rankin, an assistant professor of history at Yale University, is the mind behind radicalcartography.net, a website that makes maps look nothing like your average ordnance survey. Rankin's maps highlight everything from the etymology of North and Latin American place names to maps showing where in the world is the most frequently place struck by lightning, giving travellers a fresh view on the places they may end up. Our New York editor, Aisha Spears, travelled to Yale, sat down with Rankin and asked him how he became so interested in maps.
I actually came to maps through design school. I went to architecture school at Rice in Houston. And a lot of that was about how, you know, drawings can really sort of make a big difference in what a design is about, right? So if you draw it one way or another way, it actually matters. And so when I started moving around, I spent several years traveling different cities for just a few months at a time. And that was my way of really understanding the places I was in, was starting to map them and realizing that the different kinds of maps I would make would really sort of make a difference in how I understood the city and the kinds of things that I could find or not find and things like that. A lot of the mapping I did was actually coming out of a frustration with the regular maps you'd see, which were, here we don't have the A to Z, we have the Rand McNally or the AAA and things like that, where a road is an infinitely thin line, and all you have are street names, and you have no idea what's actually going on in any of these neighborhoods. And so step one for me was to try to figure out, how can I add more information to these maps? So adding demographic information from the census, adding more sort of, you know, looking up museums and bars and parks and putting those on the subway map and things like that. And really just seeing like that, realizing, I think, that a lot of the maps we had were designed for as roadmaps to, you know, get us where we needed to go, kind of. Or if you're, you know, making deliveries all day, you need some place where you can look up the street name and get to that street. And that's not what I wanted maps for. I wanted maps to help me get out into the city, figure out what was going on, understand, you know, the way that a city like Boston had come into being, because otherwise it's really confusing and you don't understand why certain people live here instead of here, and wanting to see how I could, you know, understand history and geography together in a new way by doing different kinds of mapping.
As someone with an architectural background, how important is design to you in terms of communicating that information? Because obviously people can access this data and they can read it in a spreadsheet, or they can have a kind of clumsy map that might be produced by a government body. How important is design in what you do?
I think it's really super important. The thing that I always try to think about when I'm designing a map or talking to people about maps is to have a visual hierarchy, so that from 10 feet away, we see one thing. We get 3 feet away, we start to see something else, and you can get maybe 2 inches away and still get a lot of detail. And most maps, road maps for sure, they don't have the hierarchy built into them at all. The goal is really actually to sort of have as much data as possible all over the page, which means that it's really hard to have, you know, a clear argument, to have a clear sense of what's going on. And so I'm always trying to figure out how can I have a hierarchy. Usually it's three levels like that. The one big thing, something that you sort of supports that, and then some real detail as you get closer.
Why has cartography and why has mapping changed so much? Is it because people now don't really need to follow a big road map? They can get that on, TomTom. Is there still a kind of need to have beautifully designed maps that show other things?
I think that there's a lot of things combining to change mapping. I think a lot of it has to do with certain, you know, sort of disruptive technologies. You mentioned TomTom, which is a combination of, you know, a couple dozen satellites and a bunch of mapping data and, you know, microprocessors and all this sort of stuff. I think just as important is a real frustration that a lot of people are feeling about proprietary map information, especially in the UK and places like that. We have projects like OpenStreetMap, people trying to basically remap everything on their own under different legal terms so that everyone can share it and sort of remix it. And I think there's a real desire that a lot of people have to, that everybody wants different kinds of maps, right? I can't imagine that I was the only one that was frustrated with the roadmap. And I think that the difference is that now we have tools, but we also are really trying to push those tools in terms of either the legal structures or just the new kinds of social collaboration so that, you know, everyday people can make maps that respond to the kinds of things they're interested in.
What's the reaction of kind of the old school cartographers to the kind of work that you do, and even, I guess, to the work that, you know, Google Maps does?
I actually don't see much resistance. I mean, I'm sure that there are some curmudgeons, you know, rotting away in some sub-basement. But for the most part, cartographers are interested in this stuff. And they're interested in bottom-up mapping. They're interested in, you know, participatory GIS and things like that. One big difference is that cartographers, partly through training, partly through temperament, they're interested in bringing things to a level of polish that I think a lot of people aren't necessarily interested in. And so the maps that cartographers really get excited about are maps that are, you know, particularly good at shading mountains in a new way, really good at placing labels. And I appreciate that stuff. I certainly have that gene. But I don't think that that's, like, it's more like the public discussion and the cartography discussion are sort of talking past each other sometimes. But I don't see any hostility. A lot of cartographers and certainly scholars of cartography are always interested in how maps are used. And I don't think people have a fixed sense that you've got to be on paper or anything like that. I think that I don't do much, for example, with interactive stuff. I've done a few animations and a few interactive stuff, but that's not really where my interests go. So I don't see that I don't see people sort of saying maps have to be one thing or one other thing. I think it's much more like there are different maps for different purposes. And I think that it would, for me, it would be a shame if we said we don't no longer need big wall maps. It should all be digital things that only show a couple of things at a time. So again, I think that the answer is sort of yes. You know, let's have lots of different kinds of maps. Let's have maps for everything we want. And I don't see a sort of like, there might be an old guard, you know, Rand McNally might be struggling to keep up with the times. I don't know. But I don't really see that as an issue.
That was our New York editor, Aisha Spears, in Yale with Bill Rankin of Radical Cartography. Time for a short break now, but stay tuned. We're freewheeling all the way to Chicago to talk bikes after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Section D. Chicago's reputation for cutting-edge bike design and retail stretches back beyond the turn of the last century. Now, after several decades of dormancy, that pioneering spirit has returned. Innovative bike shops and expert frame makers are popping up all over, attracting fans and fanfare, spurring increased ridership and putting the city back on the map as one of the country's top bike destinations. Monocle's Chicago correspondent, David Lepesca, began his look into Chicago's dynamic bike scene with a visit to a new hybrid shop that's quite comfortable with its split personality.
Step through the black-framed glass door on Chicago's Lincoln Avenue and into what seems a simple, smart-looking cafe. The rich smell of pastries and freshly ground coffee waft through the cozy, sun-dappled space. Near the front, a couple in business dress chats over cappuccino. But a closer look reveals something more. At a small, roped-off workshop in the back, a mechanic is drilling into a bike fender. Welcome to Heritage Bicycles and General Store, a bike shop cafe run by Michael Salvatore in Chicago's well-to-do Lincoln Park neighborhood.
Coffee and bikes seem to go well together.
The concept is one part locally sourced sustainability, two parts come in and stay a while, and every bit an idea whose time has come. In 2008, Salvatore co-founded Bowery Lane Bicycles in New York, a business focused on locally sourced, handmade retro bikes, but only available online. Last year, he had a son and wanted to return to his hometown and start a business. He was inspired by bike shop cafes he'd heard about in Austin, Texas, and Portland, Oregon, and thought Chicago could use something similar. Since its late January opening, the shop has seen steady business, and local media coverage has been near nonstop. Some of the attraction is surely due to the fact that this is one of the few spots in the city that offers Stump Down Coffee, the Portland-based brand that has the most discriminating American coffee drinkers savoring every full-bodied sip.
Stump Down Coffee is amazing, and I think that draws a lot of people in the cafe side of it. Once we got them inside, it might come around to the main event, you know, the bicycle.
Salvatore hopes the coffee attracts customers who stick around to check out the offerings from Bowery Lane Bicycles and from the store's own Heritage line, which are assembled on-site. Both are smartly designed retro-style bikes and cost $695. Salvatore has also stocked a small retail space in the back with a selection of comfortable clothing, bags, and hats.
Aesthetically, you know, we're going for something more fashion-based when it comes to cycling. It's really about people who want to feel comfortable in their jeans and wear a hat. They feel comfortable riding it and want to be, you know, you want to promote that kind of easiness of riding. I'm trying to source locally as much as I can, but there's a lot of good brands out there that, you know, I bring in from all parts of the world.
Heritage is just one small slice of the lively and innovative bicycle scene in Chicago, a city that has been at the forefront of bike design and retail for more than a century. It was here, in 1895, that two German immigrants founded the Schwinn Bicycle Company, the dominant American bike manufacturer for much of the 20th century. In the decades that followed, Chicago was known as the bicycle building capital of America. The city's Lakefront Trail is today one of the finest urban bike rides in the country, 18 miles alongside Lake Michigan, winding past zoos and beaches, museums, marinas, parks and playgrounds, and of course, the city's gleaming skyline. In the 1990s, Mayor Richard M. Daley created a bicycle advisory council to boost bicycling, and commuter ridership has doubled in the past decade. The current mayor, Rahm Emanuel, has set a goal to make Chicago the most bike-friendly city in the country. He's installing dozens of protected bike lanes across the city and an $18 million bike share program with 3,000 bicycles and 300 stations set to launch this summer. The city has also hired New York firm Sam Schwartz Engineering to design a 150 to 250-mile bike lane network. In many cases, Chicago's bicycle innovation occurs at the intersection of design and sustainable personal transport. Gary Alderman is a former architect who combined his love for biking and metalwork a few years ago to launch Method Bicycles, his own custom-made steel frame bike business. He recently moved into a new, more spacious studio in a former meatpacking plant in Chicago's West Loop. And with his own business booming, he plans to add a retail space this spring. Alderman took a break from slicing into steel with a vertical mill to chat about his work.
I started the company like 3 years ago and it's been showing my product at local rides and events, and the reception's been really great, and people are really starting to return to the handmade object and putting a lot of value in that. You know, sure, you can go and buy a bike in a shop that's made by a machine that costs less and does the same thing for most people's perspective, but what I find a lot of really fulfilling in my practice is that the interaction with the client is that they know where their product's made.
After an initial design meeting, Alderman sketches out a one-to-one ratio drawing and begins the build-out. He meets with the client regularly over a month-long build period until the new bike, costing anywhere between $2,500 and $10,000 depending on components and accessories, is ready to ride home.
I build each frame one at a time, and that allows me to really think about what I'm doing. So if something changes along the process, I think we should do something a different way, I'll involve the client as much as they want to be. Right now I have orders for about 2 per month. It puts me at a happy pace. My goal this year is to build 30.
A couple miles north of Alderman's studio is Copenhagen Cyclery, which Brent Norseman opened below the offices of his architecture firm a few years ago. The shop is among the very few in the city, and even the Midwest, to offer handsome, rugged European models like Denmark's Velorbis and Italy's Abici. Norseman's impetus for the shop was to get people like him, 30 and 40-something professionals, riding their bikes every day.
The young kids get it, but to see, you know, the 40-somethings out on a bicycle, it's definitely a head turn. That was kind of the impetus for the shop, was to attract more people like myself. I think what attracted me to these bicycles is that they're not kind of geared the way the U.S. bicycle market is to like sport, mountain bike, and speed. They're more about comfort, style, kind of attracted by both the classic and the modern designs. Seeing bicycle as kind of an elegant form of transportation and a sophisticated one. It's kind of all about creating a better balance between the automobile and bicycle and pedestrian. That's pretty exciting.
Norseman is excited about his latest idea, which is to join forces with the cafe next door and create another Chicago hybrid.
We're going to kind of merge the spaces, but actually build a bar within our space that will open up after a certain time. So we'll be one of the first bike bars in the country.
Back at Heritage Bike Shop, Salvatore is also considering a beer and wine license. But that's some ways off. This year, he expects to sell about 50 bikes and do somewhere around $100,000 of business. He expects those totals to multiply in the years to come and envisions the Heritage brand moving beyond the Windy City.
I don't think Heritage actually stops in Chicago. The idea behind the Heritage brand is, you know, locally made bikes for the cafe situation, general store in different parts of the country. But I think there's a lot of growth for hyper-local fabrication, you know. People can be really proud of something that's made here.
Considering the happening bike design and retail scene developing here, Chicagoans might be forgiven for feeling a bit of pride.
That was Monocle's David Lepesca in Chicago. And in honor of our two-wheeled friends, it's time for another song. This is Bicycle by Memory Tapes. That was Bicycle by Memory Tapes. Now, a traveller's best friend is their luggage, and much like finding a life partner, the hunt for a perfect suitcase can be long and painful. But once found, it's a relationship that gives pure pleasure. Founded in 1897 by Englishman David Nelken in Saxony, Germany, the sturdy and beautiful luggage of Globetrotter is one of our most favourites. With more than 100 years of history, Globetrotter suitcases have passed through many famous hands, from Winston Churchill and Sir Edmund Hillary, who used the suitcases during his first Everest climb in 1951, to the slightly less intrepid Sofia Coppola and Kate Moss. The Globetrotter factory in Hertfordshire is where the cases are still made by hand, on Victorian machinery. We sent our reporter, Thea Erdl, to investigate what makes a heritage brand thrive in the 21st century.
Based in the picturesque village of Broxburn, a small 30-minute train ride outside London, lies the production site of Globetrotter. Although the British heritage luggage brand is flourishing, the small production team of 25 still take their time with every individual piece and emphasise on craftsmanship and tradition, something Globetrotter feel is an essential part of travel. Creative director Gary Bott elaborates on the history of the brand.
Globetrotter was established in 1897, so we're 115 years old today. The company started in Germany, Saxony. It was started by an Englishman, a chap called David Nelken. He moved the factory and production back to England just before World War II. We've been in the UK ever since and will remain here for the next 100 years.
In spite of its age, the design of the luggage itself has not changed over the years. The company still employs the same techniques as they did 100 years ago. A single trunk goes through 98 meticulous construction processes, and Bot talks us through the importance of each little step.
Before we can start to make a Globetrotter suitcase, we have to produce the leather trim. Our leather trim consists of our molded leather corners, our handles, and leather straps for our centenary cases. All of our leather comes from a UK tannery. Everything is cut within our leather section, molded on original Victorian presses. We use an original Victorian guillotine to cut these straps to size. We use original Victorian sewing machines, the oldest dating back to 1928, to stitch our handles. All our handles are produced from scratch, so that we even go as far as to produce the filling for each of the handles.
The corners, or the feet, as they refer to them at Globetrotter, take 5 days to make. Globetrotter has one carpenter, Roger, who builds the foundation of the case in vulcanized fiberboard. The brand is not afraid to shake things up a little, play with the format, and experiment with bold colors. Their bestseller right now is a nice hot pink number, along with a plethora of trims and linings, which all contributes to the character of each specific case and the customers who care for them.
We have customers that have been with Globetrotter. They've owned one of our cases for 20, 30, 40 years. And that's something that's quite rare, and it's special in this day and age. Whenever we have one of these customers that require a repair to their suitcase, whether it's their locks become damaged by an airline, or perhaps a case they've had for decades, the leather handle is starting to wear and needs to be replaced. 100% of the time, these customers, and they're customers in the loosest sense of the word, because they actually bought something from us 20, 30, 40 years ago. We don't have much repeat business at Globetrotter. But these customers will come into our shop in the Burlington Arcade. They'll have a beautiful example of a Globetrotter case, something that has naturally aged. The patina of the colour of the suitcase will just be beautiful. In some instances, we'll offer to either buy that case to include in our archive, or we may offer to replace their case like for like with the same size, the same color, but a brand new case for their vintage Globetrotter case. 100% of the time, we will never have a customer that will accept that offer. The case has too much value to them. It has a very similar feeling to a vintage Rolex. It holds more value than a new Rolex. And so we hope, and certainly we've seen over the many years, that customers that have a Globetrotter case, that travel with a Globetrotter case, will never part with a Globetrotter case. We are not a brand that you simply like. We have a product that people love, and I think we're very fortunate in that respect.
Due to increased demand, Globetrotter has now expanded internationally. Before 2005, the brand was only available in Japan and in their infamous shop in Burlington Arcade in London. Japan is still their biggest market to date, and they have had several successful collaborations.
So we worked with Jun Takahashi at Undercover, and he simply played with colour, so used our existing colour leather components with our existing colour vulcanized fiberboard material for the body of that we use for the body of all our suitcases. And he put together a combination that we hadn't seen before. We also used two of his seasonal prints. And what that project did is, as well as the association with Undercover, who are amazing, of course, is it put us on the catwalk at Paris Fashion Week. So then you start to see Globetrotter in a new and different context. And we don't necessarily need to sell 250 suitcases in a day to achieve some real value in that type of partnership.
Although the company is adapting to new global trends through innovative collaborations and brilliant color schemes, Globetrotter has managed to stay true to their core values by treating every piece of luggage like a part of the family.
Globetrotter is very much like an old friend. It's very much like your old passport that's well-used, dog-eared, has stamps from all over the world, memories perhaps, and it's always, certainly I feel, whenever I have to give up my old passport and apply for a new one, it's rather sad. But then you start all over again. But it is more than just simply a suitcase. It's something that holds memories and almost like a traveling companion.
That was our reporter, Thea Erdl, in Broxburn, Hertfordshire, at the Globetrotter factory. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. Next week, we'll be hearing about bridges and the music they can play. We'll be dropping into the Sao Paulo studio of Brazilian architect Marcio Kogan. And we'll head to Vienna to meet the enterprising director of the Mac Design Museum. Be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.